Hello and welcome to This Complex Life. We know that life and relationships can be a little bit messy and complicated, and on this podcast we try to have conversations about all things mental health, well-being and relationships. In today's episode, I'm unpacking the idea of navigating therapy as a BIPOC client. And if you haven't heard that term before, don't worry, I'm going to explain it in just a little moment. I'm going to be sharing some insights, well, our guest will be, and exploring ways to navigate seeking out a therapist that you find that you fit well with. I'm Marie Vakakis. I'm a therapist, mental health and relationship educator and the host of This Complex Life. And this podcast is all about making sense of the complexities of life and relationships. And today I have with me Tam. Welcome to the podcast, Tam.
Thank you. Thank you.
So Tam, you're now an educator. So you're educating other therapists and future social workers, and you work in a tertiary mental health service and alongside me at the Therapy Hub.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about, I mean, we've nutted out different topics that we could talk about today, and we decided to have a chat about finding a BIPOC therapist. Can you tell me a little bit about what that means for people who have no idea? Those who are Googling it will know what it means. Everyone else might be really confused.
Absolutely. And I think for me, it's about finding someone who you think can relate to your unique lived experiences, where you are identifying your intersectionalities and how you experience the world from self, and trying to make sense of those experiences and looking for a therapist who think can walk in those shoes or can have a related experience from that intersectionality of yours.
So there's a few things there. One is maybe being part of a certain community or communities yourself,
yeah.
And then one might be working with particular groups. The term that I have for BIPOC is, so if someone says I work with BIPOC folk, it might be that they don't have a lived experience, but I've got the definition here as Black, Indigenous and people of color.
Yeah.
So if someone is looking for a BIPOC therapist, they're looking for someone who is either Black, Indigenous or a person of color.
Absolutely.
And I've had this conversation with a few other therapists around, we don't always necessarily know how to translate our own lived experience into the workers, into therapy. So is there a difference between being a part of that community yourself and actually having done some additional work to understand, like you said, intersectionality, barriers to accessing healthcare, putting kind of words to some of that experience?
Absolutely. And I think part of being part of the community, for myself, being a Black male, is the insights and the uniqueness that I feel like I can share with my clients, or I can bring some understanding to clients in sessions about the uniqueness of experiences of what it is to be a Black person, a migrant living in a country where you are a minority or you are adhering to different standards and ways of living in terms of that sort of Western way of living, and how you're navigating the systems that are often you have to navigate. So sort of breaking it down to much more like migration, for example, I've lived as a refugee in the past in the UK and having to navigate the immigration system and the challenges that comes with that, and some of the emotional stress that causes in relationships for people. It's the uniqueness that I think I'm able to bring in that space for people who are from the same community as me, yeah.
There's so much in that. I'm not even sure where to go. My brain gets so excited with questions. One of the thoughts that came to mind as you were saying that is, and it wasn't directly related, but it's this idea of different minority groups having to educate other people on their experience, whether that be someone living with a disability, maybe based on gender or sexuality or race and religion. Do you think some of that is easier if you're finding a therapist that you don't have to kind of overt that, you don't have to wait for them to mention it, or you have to educate them? They might just know and you can have that conversation in an easier way.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So I'll share some of my sort of my personal experiences. There is this sense that you see in Australia, I see it a lot in Australia, but I also see it a lot growing up in the UK. It's like, when you see another black person in public, you sort of have to acknowledge each other, right? You sort of just nod at each other or just like a quick hello. I don't even know who their name is, but there's this sense of like we look at each other and we just acknowledge each other. And that is so common. And when I speak to other black people and go, oh, this is what I do, and they go, oh, I do the same thing too. And it's almost like this shared experience that we laugh about, but we haven't necessarily got like a term to it or why we do it. It sort of just happens. And I think those are some of the sort of the unique experiences where you really can, in session, you can really use that powerfully to delve deeper with people to understand what that connection means to them, right? And another sort of experience that I sort of think about is I've grown up having to tell my story. I've grown up in a minority. I grew up in, I remember when we moved to the UK, we were the first black family in a sort of really white British working class community. And there was a lot of like people being curious about me, right? Everywhere I go, I have to go, hi, my name is Tom. I'm from Zimbabwe. This is what I do and why I came to England. So it's since there was this fascination of like, I've spent all of my time almost with this script that I have to carry with me and say to people because people are constantly curious. And I think for me, that what I see a lot in therapy with people of my communities, they have navigated the world with a script of who they are and having to demonstrate why they are here, where they come from, brought them here, and so on and so forth. And I think in that, there is a unique experience of going, why do we have to tell our story every time? You know, and what does that mean for us that we having to constant people are so interested by us, and how we're navigating a place where we never had to tell our story when in our home countries of origin, but now we're constantly having to tell people our story, you know, and how do we experience that? Do we experience that as a form of like curiosity in other people, or do we experience it as a form of racism?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example. And I've got a group, I've been doing some teaching as well, and we're doing a topic at the moment about intersectionality, and we've got quite a few students who were talking about this idea of in their home country, there were different either tribes or community groups or different religions, and there was very distinct groups. And then they come here and they all unite on the section of race. So they're all women of color. And when they're here, they're like, we feel more connected to each other here. And all of them were from different religions. All of them had different languages. And yet that idea of intersectionality and race, it changes depending on the context as well.
Absolutely. That's a really good point, because I experienced same as well. And I think it's the way we talk about intersectionality in Western countries is different to how we may talk about it in countries of origin, in Africa, for example, right? I think a lot of our understanding of race and racism and ethnicity overall has been influenced by the sort of the American Black Perspective movement, you know, from the 60s, the 70s. About a collective group of people who are bounded by similar experiences and similar race, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you can be from Jamaica or from Ghana or from United States. If you share this identity of Black ethnicity, you are almost become a collective. And I think a lot of influences from the American sort of like Black movements, civil rights movements, really brought that together and tied the knot. And I think that's influenced a lot of our thinking when you think about ethnicity in the Western culture, where if you go to Africa, people might lean more into your second name, right? You know, your second name will say a lot about where you belong in the society, and your language, your spoken language, your tribe, and so on and so forth. That holds much more weight, I think, in countries of origin.
Yeah, I think it's so complex, and we couldn't choose in a country like Australia that's so multicultural. We can choose to be curious and unpack some of those more, and we can also, I guess, choose not to. And I think some people choose not to recognize that rich experience of different people. Mm-hmm. And I love, like, the students, I hope they listen to this, that they've been so, I've been so amazed by how, and these are future social workers, which is fantastic to see, how they've handled such delicate conversations, such big conversations around everything from race, sexuality, religion, ethnicity, migration experience, grasp of the English language, literacy, with such maturity and such kindness and compassion. And I think that's really great because we don't have a social work very similar to psychology and nursing and teaching. The unpaid student placements really mean a lot of people can't access that course.
Yeah.
And so we do have a misrepresentation, maybe not misrepresentation, but we don't have enough diversity in some of those fields, especially if they're new migrants, you know, maybe even grasping English as a language to study. And so I think some of our frameworks, some of our philosophies, what gets published, who gets into the workforce is a bit skewed to a particular privilege. Mm. And I don't know where I was going with that, but I think that's probably why we wanted to have this conversation is how do people find therapists who are qualified and also have done the work in understanding that experience as well. Mm-hmm. So after that big ramble, that made no sense. What are some of the unique challenges you see BIPOC clients face when accessing mental health services?
I think that was a great summary, by when, and you just reminded me of something that I want to come back to before I answer your question. It's like, I think the way our society shapes the way in terms of social work, I think social work is a political profession. It's a profession that reflects society, and we mirror what society tells us or says to us. And then we try and find some understanding in that and look at issues of power, discrimination, and rebalance society to become much more fairer, right? And I think in that sense, what that means is that if our society and our politics do not communicate around integration, ethnic integration, supporting people to live together, or talking in this in-depth way about race and people's experiences, it becomes very difficult as recruiters in social work to hold that lens about what is the population and what's going on. It's almost like this systemic approach, right, of feedback loops. If we are brave as a society to have these conversations around people's experiences based on their ethnicity or any other intersectionalities, I think we become much more skilled in knowing how to engage with the populations that are often feel marginalized by organizations or often feel like they're only seen through one lens, but there's also other parts of their identity that's not being equally seen as well as it could be. That sort of leads on to the question you asked. I think it's fundamentally, like, I was born in Zimbabwe, I'm a Zulu, right? Which is originally a tribe from South Africa. We have a term called Ubuntu, right? Ubuntu is the idea of, like, I am what I am because of who you are. Like, it's a shared collective sense of togetherness, right? And understanding that I am part of this wider community that I belong to. And I think ultimately what that gives me is a fundamental of people want to be seen, or we want to be heard. And when I think about the work that I do, is how do I hold a space for someone to be seen through their own lens? How do they want to be seen? So how am I curious enough about their ethnicity and how they experience the world through that? Whether it's through things like interest, like music or sports or whatever they are into, to how they deal with statutory services like police and mental health services and so on and so forth. And taking from a lens that's from the individual and looking outwards into the community rather than sort of taking a lens that looks at the organization and looking at the individual, right? How do we center people's experiences? So that's the lens that I try to take, and I find that allows me as a therapist to see a holistic person, a person as a whole, and spend a lot of time investing on who they are in our early parts of the session before we even talk about what the presenting issues are.
So, I mean, if that's part of the work you do, what are some of the challenges you see people face? Like, I mean, some that come to mind already for me is a lot of our assessment tools and being mental health social workers, social workers, we don't really, the diagnostic approach is not really what we like to do. But a lot of those assessments are based on, I mean, there's a lot of, they're usually done at like universities with white students. And so a lot of them don't have maybe as much applicability across culture. They might assume a certain language base and ability to express language in a certain way, even something as simple as the DAS, which is one of those things the GP usually does, which looks at depression, anxiety, and stress. It might say an unusually sad or irritable mood, and you might be like, those words don't mean the same to me. So, you know, there's the way we understand the presentations. But then you mentioned around interactions with medical professionals and statutory services. And that's another area that I think for some people, the services don't have a kind of anatomical representation of things, of people that look like them. You know, a lot of, I think as a female, there's a lot of literature out there around even the female anatomy not being mapped out until a couple of decades ago, and painkillers weren't used, were tested on men first. So people of color have additional things where they might have been used as trial subjects, as test subjects. There's a deeper distrust of the system.
Absolutely.
And so how do we kind of overt some of that stuff and recognize the difficulty that some people face in actually even reaching out for support, whether that's through a distrust of the system or stigma, shame, misunderstanding, fear? Like, what are some of the areas that you, the conversations you kind of see people having?
Yeah, that's a really good point and really good question, because what you said is what I see all of that in my engagement with people of color specifically, right? And the mistrust of police, the mistrust of services, even the mistrust of therapy, even coming to therapy as a person of color is so much harder, right? It's so much more difficult. Then I think for me, what I try and listen out is, where is the origin of that story coming from, right? Because often or not, it's not the mental health that's the beginning of that difficulty with services. Where does it start from? Where did that mistrust begin from? And you will find, you know, like for me, I can map everything back to, especially my time in the UK, to the immigration system. And the idea that you're constantly having to prove yourself that you are worthy to be here and belong in the society, then having to have interviews with the immigration system, and they're doing their job, you know, but that experience you can't take away from someone, of constant reminder that you don't belong here and this can be taken away from you at any point in time, especially if you also come from a country where you've escaped persecution yourself. So the fear, and what that creates, and what I see a lot of people say, is that creates a level of like conditioning to accept, this is the society that I belong in, and I'll never be good enough, right? I'll always have to constantly prove myself that I'm worthy to belong in the society. It's interesting, because I remember growing up as a kid, my parents would be like, you have to work twice as hard to be on the same level as your peers who are white, basically, right? And I felt that pressure in me. And it was so interesting, because I'll feel it from home as a sense of like motivating me to achieve greater things in education or whatever. Then I go in my community and I feel it, because I've been stopped and searched by the police 7 times in my lifetime growing up, right? And none of my friends who were white have been stopped and searched. So it's almost like what the messages I was getting at home were almost being validated by the lived experiences. So you almost become conditioned of sense of like, I constantly have to live like I have to prove myself. What happens in therapy with that sense is, I see a lot of black males mainly, and I speak from first-hand experience here, of you almost put on this shield and this armor on you, right? This armor of, you either have to defend yourself or you have to fight for your existence. And I listened to a lot of podcasts and a lot of music that was very much validating that experience, especially coming out of the Caribbean with Bob Marley, and also the civil rights movements of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, Marcus Garvey, and all the prominent Black Panther literature that I was reading was validating my experience. I don't exist in the society. I have to fight for my existence in the society. but also at the same time being fearful that if I fight too much, I might get arrested and put in prison and deported back to my country. So it's like a paradoxical world that you live in, right? You're trying to escape persecution from your home country, but you don't feel fitting in the society. So you put on this armor. And I think sometimes what happens in therapy is we listen to the dangers that armor might bring in terms of being able to relate to other people, right? And that's where conflict in relationships and relationship dynamics become very, very difficult, is when someone has to constantly have that armor on and they're worried about taking it off because what that means for them.
There's so much in that. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about, you know, there's the experience of racial profiling, there's the experience of the threat of migration, being deported. Mm. And then as soon as you mentioned the armor, I was thinking about, you know, that vulnerability and how hard it is to be tender and to be caring and nurturing and loving and intimate with someone if there's a feeling of hypervigilance that goes about your day. And that's really hard. And I think of some of the, you know, like I think of maybe if you and I were in a room together and we were both having experiences of depression and it presented as irritability, people's responses to us would be very different.
Absolutely.
They might think maybe I'm a little crazy, or, you know, if I'm crying, they might comfort me and they might be scared of you.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, sometimes we have to overt that. That does mean that there's less spaces where some people can really let their guard down or share their story without fear of being seen as aggressive or angry or an incompetent parent, or have their children taken away or receive all sorts of hateful comments and threats. And I don't know what the answer is, but I guess maybe this is one of many conversations we'll have. And we've got some other team members who'll be having conversations with us around this same topic. But it's really tricky.
It's such a tricky space, right? Because especially in mental health, I'm always curious. I don't know about the statistics much in Australia, how much we measure people's experiences of services based on ethnicity. But a lot in the UK, a lot of UK sort of census and population understanding is based on ethnicity. And there is overwhelming of black males who are sectioned in mental health hospitals, right? Per population. The highest group is black males, right? Or an overpopulation. And we kind of see it, we see it here in the different contexts with First Nations people and incarceration, right? And per capita and the life. So it happens here. And I'll be curious to see how do we expand our lens to bring in more ethnic understanding when it comes to intersecting with services, especially where there's a great power imbalance, right? Where there is a huge power imbalance about who gets to make decisions over your life and how are they holding your identity when they're making those decisions. You said something really powerful about our different experiences. If we were to express maybe, I don't know, some frustrations about our experiences, it's fascinating because often or not, you grow up as a black male, young black man, and there's this stigma that you're always angry, right? You're always angry and constantly you feel like people think you're up to no good. You know, people are constantly, you go and stand somewhere, people are looking at you, what's going on, you know, and the police will stop you. And there's this sense like you have to be so polite, overtly polite, that you don't want to give anyone with power, statutory power, the reason to arrest you. I remember that narrative growing up as a kid, my parents talking to me, if you get stopped by the police, just do as I say, don't challenge it, even if you feel like you want to challenge it, because what you see as being challenging, they could label that as aggressive behavior. And the power imbalance in that relationship is they can arrest you and detain you, right? Mm. So those are some of the skills and the ways that we navigated, are navigated. And I think a lot of black male navigate, that's the armor that I'm basically talking about, right? I don't deal with those emotions of like, I'm angry, this is not okay, because if I express that, I'm being aggressive, so I have to hold on to that. And where do I take that to? Because if I leave it in my body, it's not good for my personal well-being. And what I see a lot in therapy is then it gets transferred into relationships at home, right? Mm. That frustration is just comes out in a home where maybe people might feel more relaxed to express themselves.
As you mentioned, that where does that go? I'm reminded by some of the, and I don't know if there's a lot of like official research into this, but this idea of microaggressions and micro racism having an impact on somebody's stress hormones, which can lead to a lower life expectancy and higher rates of, you know, inflammatory conditions and the whole range of things. So that stress, that hypervigilance, and when we say hypervigilance, it's that idea of, well, let's say your house got broken into and then every time you start to hear a crackling noise, your body might be kind of on alert. Some people have that hypervigilance everywhere they walk through.
Yes.
And so they're looking out for danger, for a threat, for their safety being compromised. And that has an impact in so many ways.
Absolutely. Can I just touch on something really important that you're saying? Because I think that stress as well, because you haven't got anywhere to take it to, you kind of sort of wear it. It's like, it reminds me sort of, I don't know the exact quote I read, but this concept reminds me of the body keeps the score in that book, so powerful. And I think what happens, especially as a person of color, is you get beaten so much by the system and you get to accept this is how things are, if that makes sense, right? So to a certain extent, it's like you're feeling this stress, but you almost become conditioned to this is just, I have to feel this way, right? And then when things like, it's always fascinating because sometimes I meet people of color or families of color in therapy and they will be like, have this sense of like, oh, that's just nothing. Like, no, I'm like, what you're going through is a very, very difficult. But it's almost like that sense of like, no, this is just nothing. We're just used to this. We used to live with injustice. We used to live with, you know, even though we don't like it, we become conditioned and accept it. It's almost like we've learned how to just accept this is how we're going to be and how life has to be for us to exist in this society. And I think sometimes it can be so hard to penetrate that in therapy, because effectively that's you asking them to take off their armor, right? And what's underneath there is a level of vulnerability, you know, and if I become vulnerable, I have to hold everything together. If I become vulnerable, no one's going to feel sorry for me in society. You know, the society has made me this way. So I have made my lane. And this is why I think these are some of the reasons why often people of color, it takes longer for them to trust services, or it takes longer for them to come forward and seek therapy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we try really hard here at the Therapy Hub. We have probably half our team would be people of color. Mm. And so that's quite rare, I think, to have a service like that. So I guess maybe the first thing is you don't just work with people of color.
No,
you work with, you know, you work with everyone. It's not like you just work with, you know, young black men, for example.
That's right.
So what advice would you give? So, you know, if anyone's listening and you like Tam's vibe, come and see him. He's great. But if someone is specifically looking for a therapist with some of the intersectionality that they relate to, what advice could you give those folk who, you know, might be looking for a BIPOC therapist, or they're trying to consider therapy but they're not sure, maybe there's a bit of mistrust? What can they look for and how can they start to navigate that system?
Absolutely. I would say, firstly, the fact that you're thinking about therapy is a good thing. It's you listening to your body and saying, I want to process through what's going on for me, and I think therapy is the best place for me to do so. So well done for being in that place, because it takes a long time to get in that place as a person of color, given everything we just discussed. Secondly, I would say if your ethnicity and the experiences based on your ethnicity is important, you wanna feel like you're going to find someone who's much more relatable to you, absolutely reach out to that person. But I'm also at the same time, because what we just identified here as well is that how we think about intersectionality in the Western sphere is different to how people in the countries of origin, people think about it as well. So what you can find is some clients will hold those two different perspectives of intersectionality. So they might go, I'm happy to work with a person of color, but culturally it can't be a male because in my culture, I can only speak to females about female business type of thing. Do you see what I mean? So I think listen to those both voices and reach out to where you think you're going to be most heard and start off from there. And I think what that does is it helps people go through the door of what therapy is. And it also opens up opportunities to see that there's some amazing people of all different colors, races, genders, ethnicity in the space of therapy that you might not necessarily find that you fit better with someone of different ethnicity to you. But now that you know how the idea of therapy is, it gives you that confidence to go, let me try someone different later on in the future, right? You can expand your horizon. So I think use it. It's definitely a good opportunity as a gateway to just try therapy out because I think therapy is powerful. I love therapy. I'm a therapist. I'll say that. But I think it's such a powerful tool that I think sometimes getting through the door is just as hard, you know. And if we can make it easy through how we are as a therapy hub where we have people of all different ethnicities, we are basically talking, looking out at the community, and we work in Footscray, which is one of the most multicultural communities in Melbourne. This is us as a service looking out to the community to saying, we are here, we're representing the community. Representation is so important for me. Growing up as a kid, I wanted to see people who look like me, you know, not only through in certain stereotypical settings, but I wanted to see someone who looks like me who reads the news. I wanted to see someone who looks like me who talks about finance and politics, a teacher, a lawyer. You know, those are representations I wanted to see in my community. And I think we have the privilege to do that at the Therapy Hub. And we are doing that. And I just encourage people of color, anyone who wants to attend therapy and their ethnicity is important to them, reach out. And you're going to find there's amazing people beyond ethnicity that will also be willing and skilled to help you.
Mm. I love what you said. You said something around finding, I think it was the right fit for you. Mm. And I would encourage folk to, I mean, they can reach out. There's nothing wrong with contacting an intake person or admin, whether it's us or somewhere else, and asking, you know, some basic questions of, these are some of the things I'm concerned about. Do you have a member of your team that is comfortable or confident in that space? They don't have to be an expert, but actually saying, these are my concerns, is that person comfortable to work with that? Mm. You can interview them a little bit as well.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's also like dating. You've just got to find the right fit.
Yes, absolutely.
The right date.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time today, Tam. It has been a really interesting conversation. I think it won't be the last one we have on this topic.
Very much so. Thank you so much, Marie. Really enjoyed myself.
Thank you for listening. To keep the conversation going, head on over to Instagram or LinkedIn and follow me. If you'd like to keep updated with episodes and other interesting things happening in mental health, join my weekly This Complex Life newsletter, where I'll share tools, tips, and insight. There's a link in the show notes. Got a question you want answered? Shoot me an email or a DM. I'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the podcast.